Hello again. Welcome to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on the line today is Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager has been with us a couple of times this week already, but there were so many calls and emails left unanswered, we decided to bring him back once again. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University at Albany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. His research focuses on alterations in the immune system that make the elderly more susceptible to disease. He explores the impact of aging on immunity, which feels relevant at this time. If you have a question for Dr. Yeager, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But the number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Well, our old friend Dr. Yeager's back. Hello, sir.
Hello, Ray. How you doing today?
Well, I tell you what, there's never been a time in my life doing this show that we've ever had a guest on more than once in a week, and now this is thrice for you. So good job, man. Great to have you back.
Well, honored to be here. Thank you.
Well, you know, these are crazy times and tough times and very tense times, and I find that with you on this program, at least we get a little sense of reality and we can idle it back just a little bit. So let's start where we picked up last time. Or let's pick up where we left off last time, I should say. And we were talking about antibodies. And my question that I left unasked because we ran out of time, what exactly is an antibody? What does it look like? And how does it fight a virus?
All right. So if you think of an antibody molecule as the letter Y, so the Y has two arms, and each of those arms recognizes pieces of the virus. So the virus has those proteins we talked about and a couple other different appearances. Viruses have these proteins on their surface, that lock and key idea that allows those viruses to get inside cells. So we're hoping to have antibodies that can bind to those proteins on the surface of the virus and prevent it from getting inside cells. So they can't get inside cells, they can't replicate, they can't cause disease. And that's the whole idea behind antibody therapeutics and the idea of developing an effective vaccine.
And the body will create those on its own?
Correct. So the body, as I mentioned, is designed to fight off new viruses, new bacteria. We've evolved to do this. So our immune system is developed to recognize. It takes time, though. So if you get exposed to a virus, it's going to take, typically, 10 to 14 days for your body to make these antibodies to protect you. And your own antibodies will seek out the virus, kind of like a heat-seeking missile, bind to those viruses, and it'll cause them to be destroyed by your immune system.
Now, go ahead.
Sure. Oh, I was going to say, the difference here with the idea of a vaccine is we can get that process to happen in a very similar fashion. We just kind of avoid the potential for damage that can occur due to a natural infection. So the idea of natural immunity versus vaccine-derived immunity is, and that's where the efforts are right now, is can we identify what antibodies are helpful? Because our body makes hundreds of antibodies against pathogens. It's which ones are the most helpful. So a lot of companies are kind of racing to find out which ones are helpful and can we mass produce those in a kind of a therapeutic form, or does that allow us to instruct how to make better vaccines?
In the old detective movies, there's a detective who has a skeleton key, and it'll open everything. I take it there is no skeleton key antibody that basically has a certain effect, maybe not complete, but some effect on all of these.
Yeah, it seems like in general, with how the immune system works, it's a specific antibody for each pathogen or whatever you're exposed to. Mm-hmm. So with this virus in particular, you want something highly specific for this virus so you're assured that it's going to bind to SARS-CoV-2 and protect us against that. And it does seem like from other experimental studies that they've looked at in animal studies that when they test the ability of different vaccine approaches to work, the protection they get in these animals are directed against that virus. So it seems like the possibility of getting kind of this universal, we talk a lot about a universal flu vaccine, the idea of a universal coronavirus vaccine is not quite certain yet.
Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences is our guest on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. Just a couple of more questions, and then we'll jump on the phones here. The first one is about not necessarily vaccination, but treating an illness such as this. And my basic question is, when we get an infection, whether it be bacterial or viral, we often get a fever. And I'm told, and of course this is just what I'm told. It's old wives' tales, perhaps, but it's our body fighting that virus. And why is a temperature or a fever necessary to do that?
A great question. So the many times when you're sick, the symptoms you're feeling is often the body's response to that infection. So a fever is your body raising the temperature to make it harder for bacteria and other pathogens to survive. So the same thing is true with a kind of fever, aches, chills, and pains you feel. A lot of that is due to chemicals your body's immune cells are producing. These chemicals are called cytokines. They're messages that can be passed from cell to cell across your body. So it can kind of be a group text or a text to the cell itself. So they're these messages that orchestrate your entire immune response. And again, their goal is to help protect us, but in that way, they also cause some of the effects we feel with the disease. And on the other flip side of that is that in some cases, our body can overreact with these chemical messengers, these cytokines, and lead to damage of cells. And that's what we fear could be happening in a subset of patients with this virus.
Last question, and then we'll get back to the phones, or we'll start with the phones. There has been some talk, and depending on which news channel you're watching, this is the greatest thing of all time, or the not necessarily anything at all. We're talking about chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, and I guess these are anti-malarials, right?
Correct. So I'm amazed kind of on a, you know, each day you turn on the news or read some scientific articles, and there's just a wealth of information out there. So yeah. As you mentioned, the current drug of interest that was the topic of the president's address is chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. And these are old drugs. They've been around since the 40s and 50s, and they were developed to treat malaria. So malaria is still a health concern in tropical areas. And the reason why this drug is being looked at is there were some evidence in experimental lab-based studies that this drug could impact the ability of certain viruses to replicate. And the mechanism is such that the virus we talk about, the SARS-CoV-1, the CoV-2, sorry, virus, again, uses it lock and key, gets inside of cells, and you kind of think of it as an egg. That egg cracks open, and it releases the genetic material, the blueprints, to make more virus. Well, experimental studies suggest that this chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine may prevent that from happening effectively. Additionally, there have been some studies that suggest that chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine might dampen the inflammatory response your body makes. So I mentioned with this virus, there are some individuals that have an overactive immune system, and that leads to collateral damage or damage to our lung tissues of the patients. So there's some data that suggests that these drugs could reduce inflammation. And I need to stress, though, unfortunately, that we have this experimental data. There's no currently FDA-approved treatment or vaccine for SARS-CoV-2. What we have here is we have evidence, very small pieces of evidence from a few patients that this drug may have impacted positively the course of their disease. And what's needed is this drug has to be taken and gone through a rigorous process of scientific investigation through how drugs are normally tested through different phases.
But now, as a practical matter, Dr. Yeager, sure. This drug has been around since the late 40s or early 50s. We know pretty much the side effects, and I understand there may be occasionally some cardiac side effects, and I don't know how mild they are, but we right. know what the side effects are. What is the harm if somebody is already suffering from COVID-19? Say, oh, let's try this.
Right. So your listeners may have heard of the term compassionate use a few times during the presidential address. And what that allows is companies to provide, the FDA allows companies to provide experimental drugs to people outside of trials. So if they have a serious or life-threatening condition, that can be done. Now, that's in a very, you know, it's a rigorous process in a very small number of cases because the overall goal of the FDA is to ensure that these drugs are safe, not, you know, safe in the short term, but also the long term. What if these drugs might have some long-term effects on a patient's health? So while these drugs have been known for decades, they still need to be tested through this process to ensure that, yes, maybe we can kind of go through the safety phase a little bit with some certainty, but the next phases are going to look at efficacy. We don't know for certain how effective that is. So they might be safe, but maybe they have little or no effect on the patient that's infected. The other issues of with these reports is that their use has been in those compassionate use situations where the patients are very sick. So we need to find out, is this going to work for patients that are ambulatory? Patients out, you know, if you're sick, sitting at home, can you order this stuff as a script and take it at home and your symptoms go away? So the different situational aspects of when this drug could be prescribed.
Doctor, go ahead. Finish that up.
Sure, now. Sorry. Just basically that, it's fantastic that we have, as I mentioned, we know the biology of the virus. We have very large number of companies. I counted today at over 10 to 20 different trials that are planning or are actually ongoing to test different drugs and vaccines. So we're there. We just need to kind of go through that process because we want to make sure that people don't get harmed as we rush to a therapy or vaccine.
Dr. Eric Yeager of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences is our guest. Did I tell you how grateful we are that you're here? Yeah, I did that, right?
You did, and I appreciate Ray and WMC giving this opportunity to speak to your listeners, and I hope everyone out there listening as well, that their families are well. Ray, I hope you're well and your family as well.
About the same.
Not going stir crazy, I hope, at home, keeping the kids busy with the Wii.
Well, more or less. All right, let's go to the phones now, and James in Fultonville, you're first. James.
Hi, my question was, hello,
you're on.
Does the coronavirus affect people differently based on their blood type?
That's a good question. We've seen that in the news.
Yeah, great question, James. So there's been some data out there that in the Chinese situation, so because they've experienced the outbreak sooner than us, they have some data they can now examine. And we'll do the same process once this dies down, and it will. We'll have a plentiful data to look at, both about cases and social aspects of this disease. So the idea of blood type, there was a small study that suggested perhaps individuals with an A blood type might do differently during infection. Now, something to look at and be kind of wary of, but it still is going to require much larger studies to see, is there really a linkage between a person's blood type and how they'll respond to the infection? So again, something to be considered, but we're not quite sure really what that full impact is going to be.
James, thank you very much for the call. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest on Vox Pop. Mahalia in Albany, you're on.
Hi. My question is, taking vitamin C, C as in cat, and D, D as in dog, and zinc for older people, does that help them actually prevent the virus?
They kind of go in the grocery aisle and you see kind of that emergency and some other therapies. So there are, some anecdotal evidence that maybe these vitamin supplements could have an effect, but right now there's no studies going on that are showing specifically, or testing specifically, I should say, that these supplements are going to have an effect on the infection and the course of disease. Now, that being said, I think it is important to practice some self-care. So good nutrition, getting enough sleep, if you can, with all this kind of news cycles and stress involved, but getting sleep, eating well, going out and exercise if you can. So that's all very important to maintain a healthy immune system.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. You were last on this program on Tuesday. And I guess, Dr. Yeager, I could ask you this. What have you learned in the ensuing couple of days?
I've really just learned that situations evolve rapidly. So both with what we understand about this virus, the approaches we're taking to combat its spread, and just its impact on all aspects of life. So myself being a college professor, it's really impacted my ability to offer my classes, and we're trying to do that remotely now, and our college has been fantastic in providing us resources to do that. But it's just the amount of adjustment that it's taken in all aspects of our life, it's been quite astounding.
I assume that some of your classes involve lab work. It's got to be tough to do that remotely.
It is. Yeah, a number of my classes do involve hands-on lab work, as other classes taught here. So we fortunately have some staff here that have been great to work with to help us adapt some of those approaches to offer a similar experience to students remotely. That might be, for my own case here, maybe me doing the experiment, getting back in the lab and videotaping it for students to watch. So it's not the same as hands-on. Hands-on is the best, but at least they get a demonstration of things we would do in the lab and gain some appreciation of that technique and then learn from it.
Dr. Eric Yeager, our guest today from Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, for the third time this week on Vox Pop, which is a record if you're scoring at home. Jane in Woodstock. Jane, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. I'm a caregiver for somebody who's at risk. He has emphysema and he's been shut in. And about 2 weeks ago, I had fatigue, so I self-sequestered myself for almost 2 weeks. It's going to be 2 weeks coming up pretty soon. And I was wondering if I don't have a fever or anything, and I'm not exhibiting any symptoms. I can't get a test, but I was wondering whether it's safe for me to go and take care of him.
That's a great question, Jane. I've kind of dealt with that myself with questions from family members of how to deal with taking care of loved ones in situations when maybe they're sick or you become sick. And so fortunately for you, I can say that it's been a decent amount of time where you haven't experienced symptoms. Looking at the CDC guidelines, if you don't experience a fever or symptoms, and it's been over that 12, that's a pretty long period for you, it seems safe to say that you are likely not infected. I know it is frustrating that testing is not available to confirm that you truly aren't infected, but it seems like with the CDC guidelines, you're in the clear to resume your caregiver activities. Now, with that being said, it's still recommended that if you're dealing with individuals that are vulnerable, to still follow all those guidelines and precautions that have been stressed in numerous outlets. So hand washing, disinfecting surfaces, sneezing or coughing into your elbow, and just monitoring yourself and loved ones for symptoms.
Okay, Jane?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Now, I heard, I think it was Fauci today, it might have been Vice President Pence, say that this particular virus is three times more it's infectious than the flu. And we talked about, you and I, the first couple of days you were on, about the candy shell, the protein in the harder candy shell in the envelope. Is that what makes it easier to get a virus like this? Is it the shell?
The ability of a virus to infect is the shell certainly is part of that. And this virus has the shell plus the envelope and the proteins on that raft to infect cells. So it part of its ability to infect people and infect certain tissues is part of that overall infectivity, but it's also its ability to be transmitted via aerosol droplets. Is it a foodborne pathogen? Is it a waterborne pathogen? It also depends on the population. Are there susceptible individuals? So it's kind of a very complex equation to figure out how infectious the virus is. And some people in the audience may have heard the term R-naught. And what that equates to is how infectious is a pathogen. So if this virus, again, as the vice president said, is maybe about three times more infectious than the seasonal flu. So one, how many cases can one infected person cause in the population, a naive, unimmune population?
Do you think that the current measures, and some of them are quite drastic, New York, California specifically, do you think the current measures are concomitant with the infectiousness of this?
I think that's part of it, is that we know from what has happened, unfortunately, in parts of China and Europe, that you see the level of cases go up and the level of hospitalizations and fatalities goes up. And all these measures that are being taken, so New York has, I saw the numbers here, we have 7,000 cases, which corresponds to about half of the cases in the United States right now. So it's really what the efforts that are being taken, as frustrating as and inconvenient as they are, is still that idea we're trying to flatten the curve. And I'm sure people kind of see that everywhere now. It's on the sign as I drove into work. So what it really is we're trying to do is we're planning for the cases you don't see. So it's really we're planning out weeks of what we're trying to prevent happening. So there's been a lot of modeling looking at if we didn't do anything, what would be the number of cases, what would be the number of hospitalizations, what would be the number of deaths? And the numbers are staggering. We don't want to get there. So really what we're trying to do is, can we do something now to lessen that burden later? And it is frustrating. Life seems normal outside. We can't see the pathogen. It's a virus not easy to see. Many of us fortunately don't know an individual that is sick right now, but what we're trying to do really is to prevent, when the cases come, that they're not as severe as we had feared. So
I guess I understand what you're saying, but I guess my question for you, Dr. Yeager, is do you believe that the measures being taken are justified for what we are facing?
Good. So my own personal opinion is yes, based upon what we've seen happen in places that don't instill some control efforts. Again, as drastic as they are, and I think really the effects of what we're doing, the ripples, if you will, like kind of throwing a pebble into a pond, these ripples are going to have long-term effects to people's careers, their jobs, their families. But comparing that to being able to see a loved one at a holiday, Christmas or a birthday party next year, it's really, can we do something now for the betterment of the community?
Are you optimistic that these measures will work?
I am. Looking at some of the models that have been put out there in papers and seeing where places like China, for example, that really took severe, even more drastic measures than we have, they did get to that light at the end of the tunnel where they had, you know, case numbers drop precipitously.
Let's take a break here, Doc. We have to take care of some underwriting, and then we'll get back to the phones and the emails. 800-348-2551 is our number. Vox Pop, Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you, and the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences is our guest. And Dr. Yeager, one email here from Anonymous. Anonymous writes, I am over 60, and due to a car crash, had a splenectomy over 30 years ago. Two questions. One, if I contracted the virus, would this put me at increased risk? I think I had a pneumovax within the last 10 years. And two, am I at any increased risk of getting the virus?
So the idea of the spleen is being an important part of your immune system. So the spleen is a site where those antibodies we talked about, those Y-shaped molecules, are produced by cells called B cells, and your spleen houses a large number of B cells. So individuals that lack a spleen, they can have some susceptibility to primarily bacteria that have their own candy shell. In terms of splenectomy and the incidence of this virus, it's still not established, but individuals that lack a spleen can still make antibodies. So if they were infected with something, they can still make antibodies. If they get a vaccine, they can still make antibodies. So I think this individual would still be able to mount an immune response against a virus.
Okay.
Concomitant with that is the individual's age. I think you said it was 60, and we still have data that suggests that individuals 60 and above are at an increased risk, hence all these efforts we're doing to really stay indoors, is to protect those individuals 60 and above, because the levels of hospitalization and the levels of mortality increase in those individuals as they get older, particularly in the age group of the 80s to above.
All right, let's jump back to the phones here. 800-348-2551. Sandra in Adams has been waiting a long time here. I hope not wasting her time. Sandra, you're on.
No, I'm not wasting my time.
Good.
Thank you for taking the question. I'm in that elite group of, I'm 75 years old and I have emphysema, so this is a very dangerous thing for me. And I've always been on high alert every flu and cold season, but this puts it into a whole other category. Would I likely have to be into this be very wary category for the next year and a half till there's a vaccine that comes along?
Well, thanks for taking the line, Sandra, and thanks for that comment. So so as you mentioned, it's not just this virus we have to worry about. So there's seasonal flu each year. So I just want to stress to individuals, like, there is a flu is still throughout the population now. Not to add to your concern, but just that some of the symptoms you might be feeling could be flu as well, hence the need for the testing and clinicians asking about
I have things, no so. Symptoms.
Good.
I'm having
good.
No symptoms.
Good.
I'm not sick, thankfully.
Good.
But
good.
I'm just wondering, do I have to be on this high alert status until
right.
a vaccine is available?
Yeah, I think unfortunately it seems like until we have a better handle on numbers and a vaccine,
yep.
where the thought is in papers that I've read and in other seminars I've listened to, is that the idea is that this virus is probably going to persist at a low level in our population for the time being. Usually viruses can be dealt with, there's a lot of viruses that still we haven't eliminated. So smallpox is one, a big success story for humankind. We're able to eradicate it so it no longer exists. But diseases like polio and measles, even though we have vaccines, they're still present in the population. So the hope is we get a vaccine and a vaccine properly tested, a vaccine that's effective as soon as possible. It could be 12 to 18 months. Along with that is as people get exposed, the idea is that individuals will begin to develop immunity. So as the population develops immunity, it does become harder for the virus to spread. In a population, we call that herd immunity. So via natural infection or a vaccination, eventually we hope to get to the point where it's less likely a virus can travel and cause large number of cases like we're seeing now. So I think long
That's
story, you know, so it's like, you know, kind of a few chapters ahead in this book is that there is a happy ending, if you will.
Yes.
I think unfortunately right now it's kind of the wait and see, and really just we need to get a vaccine safely developed, put out in the population, and then we'll have a little bit easier time with dealing with this outbreak. So I think it's still vigilance on your
hope.
Part is warranted. yeah, exactly.
There's definitely some hope in that. Thank you very much.
Exactly.
Thanks,
you're welcome,
Sandra.
Sandra.
You know, you say smallpox essentially eradicated, polio not, but yet there's a vaccine.
Right.
Why is polio still hanging around and smallpox is eradicated?
Good question. So for smallpox, it has a bit to do with the virus itself, how infectious it is, and our ability to identify cases and eradicate those cases. So smallpox took, we had a vaccine that was successful against it, and then it took a large worldwide effort over many, many years, and to the point where health providers, epidemiologists would travel to remote areas of the world looking for cases, trying to stamp out that last final case. So it's not easy to do, but it was done for smallpox. For polio, we're close. Polio is less endemic. So I mean, endemic means that the virus is ever present in the population. So it's endemic in fewer areas in the world. So typically, we see it now in parts of Afghanistan and Pakistan, areas that have maybe a little less sanitation. There's some social issues and some wars going on. If we give the vaccine and keep the vaccine at herd immunity levels, that term I use, herd immunity, is with vaccines too. If a certain percent of the population is vaccinated, the virus is less able to go from person to person. So polio and some of those areas of the globe, we haven't gotten there yet. And we're trying to get, there's some other fascinating things about the polio vaccines in that story, but that's the next virus we're hoping to eliminate, kind of the next, sunny chapter, is that we can develop procedures to get a vaccine to those individuals we might be closer to eradicating polio.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest, and back to the phones we go to Anita in Clinton. Anita, you're on.
Hi, I'm responsible for cleaning my church, and I wondered what's the best procedure, and since it's closed every week for 6 days, do I need to worry about anything?
It's a good question. So there's some studies showing how long the virus seems to persist on surfaces, and we've talked some previous shows that the studies look at cardboard, stainless steel, and copper, maybe not objects found in your church. But it does seem that if you're able to clean with approved cleaners, and I refer individuals to, again, the CDC website because they list a number of cleaners. They also list recipes for making your own. Again, hand sanitizers and disinfectant wipes still might be a little harder to come by in your stores, even with the altered hours. You can make your own disinfecting solution with bleach. So I would recommend if that church has been closed up for 6 days, open it up. Just to be safe, disinfect those surfaces as you can safely. And if you're using it, again, disinfect before going in and before leaving. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
You know, Eric, we see on the TV, and I watch TV news so much until my wife says turn it off and then I have to turn the Flintstones on. But we see, especially in Europe, I see footage of people in hazmat suits essentially spraying something on subway cars or in streets or wherever. What are they spraying?
I'm not sure what they're spraying. My best guess would be there are hospital-grade disinfectants that are available to municipalities and to hospitals, and these disinfectants are made a little bit differently. They still have a antiviral activity, and when they're sprayed on surfaces, an important aspect to think about with cleaners is contact time. So it's how long does that cleaner have to be on the surface to inactivate, be it the virus or a bacterium. So my guess is they're using a cleaner that is shown to be effective against other coronaviruses, and it's been proven that it could be sprayed, kept on the surface, and it's safe for individuals to then use those services afterwards.
I'd love to get some of this for my house, so maybe we can find out what that is on your next appearance, which will be in a couple of days at this rate. Now let's go to John in Hopewell Junction. John, you're on. Hello, John.
Yes, I'm here. Just a quick question and I'll hang up.
Okay.
Regarding the ventilators, a lot of people that have sleep apnea, myself, is there any way those could be used as a ventilator?
The CPAP machines.
CPAP machines. I haven't read or heard anything about them being kind of repurposed as a ventilator. My understanding is ventilators are pretty specialized, pretty high-tech devices, hence the lack of those, and kind of some calls for the government to step in and kind of mandate perhaps some companies to start producing more.
I'm no expert, but I don't believe you could use a CPAP as a ventilator.
Yeah.
A different kind of pressure, I think. Let's go now over to Joan in Greenwich. Joan, you're on.
Hello. I would just like the doctor to clarify something he said a little earlier. As someone with type A blood, I heard the answer to the question, do people with different blood types respond differently? And I don't know what the differently means in terms of my blood type.
Sure, I'm happy to clarify. So there was a so the earlier caller, James, being a future scientist, I think he found some evidence there that there's a paper, some reports out there out of China that perhaps there was a link between certain blood types and the percentage of individuals that were sickened by this SARS-CoV-2 virus. It was a small sampling of people, so although it's something to watch, right now there isn't a much larger study that's being done, and I'm sure they're still examining this as cases continue to pile up in the United States. They'll continue to look at that, but right now there's not a clear link between an individual's blood type and the infection. That being said, I've seen numerous times on radio and TV that the Red Cross is in desperate need of blood donations, so I still believe it's safe to do so, and I do encourage people to donate blood to help those that are in hospitals.
Joan, thank you very much for the call. There's so much information out there. Have you seen a situation where there is so much information about something that you know so much about? Do you yell at the TV and the radio very often, Eric?
No, I think first, I know a lot, but there's a lot I don't know. So I'm continually learning and relearning, particularly with this virus. What I see a lot out there is there's kind of some comments on social media that have some small fraction of science behind it. But then there's a lot of misinformation. One example was in terms of how to treat food from takeout places. And I see different ways people deal with takeout and worrying about takeout food being a source of contamination or infection. I've seen things. I think early on people were drinking bleach, of all things.
Oh, so my God, no. No.
No, exactly. So there's a lot of information. I think with this being that it's such a high-intensity, high-anxiety environment right now,
yeah,
we get these reports about the blood type, about the maybe use or not use of certain NSAIDs like ibuprofen.
Yep.
Could this virus be spread by the oral fecal route? There's some linkage between people that experience digestive diarrhea symptoms with this infection. So there's things that come up that we have some information, but it's it still has to go through that rigorous scientific process, which unfortunately takes time, but it needs to be replicated in a lab. It needs to be replicated more than once to be proven or disproven.
You know, Dr. Fauci was on TV last night, and he was talking about the question of ibuprofen and acetaminophen. And he said there's some studies that say, yeah, ibuprofen might not be good, but it's not proven yet.
Correct. It's probably something that's being looked at. And not only just the ability of this particular drug, ibuprofen, to either cause symptoms to get more severe, there's also considerations about long-term use. I know from my colleagues that are pharmacists, many of these drugs, they have side effects.
Yeah.
So sometimes not using or using a drug can have effects on the body as well. So there's, in some cases, I've read some papers that acetaminophen might be better to use. It does have some liver toxicity. But the ibuprofen linkage between disease, as I mentioned, I might have mentioned maybe my other appearances, the link there is that there's some evidence that perhaps using ibuprofen might change that, the expression of that, we talked about that lock and key the virus used to get inside cells.
Yeah.
So it could be kind of a improved ability of the virus to open up that door. Again, it's not been shown scientifically yet. It's just kind of more anecdotal evidence.
Yeah.
But right now it seems like there's no no clear recommendation by either the CDC or WHO to not use it.
All right, let's jump over to the lines and get at least one or more, two before we wrap up. Barbara in Albany. Barbara, you're on.
Hi. You were saying a little while ago that my aches and pains and fever that I get with a flu or virus is my immune response. If I don't like that and I take acetaminophen to make it go away, is that getting rid of my immune response or my ability to feel my immune response?
Right. I love these immunology questions, being that's my background. So I agree. It's like, you want to, the things you're experiencing, as I mentioned, are in most cases part of your body's immune response and ability to fight off whatever you're infected with. And there is some thought that perhaps if you were to use an anti-inflammatory, is that going to prolong the time it takes your body to fight off that infection? I don't know of any studies that have been done to say definitely don't do this, rather than just bear it out. I don't know if that's necessarily, but definitely it's kind of a balance between, quality of life, being able to do what you need to do on a daily basis. So managing symptoms as you can with a drug that's not going to cause side effects accordingly. So I think it's still, if you're, be it this virus or any other infection you have, if you feel aches and pains, I wouldn't say don't take acetaminophen. I think your immune system is going to be just fine. The bigger concern is if you use it at higher doses, there might be some toxicity issues.
All right, let's go to Susan in Schenectady. Susan, you're on.
Yes, hello. My husband and I are both over the age of 60. Our son, who was just in the Peace Corps in the Gambia, is being sent home, and they're warning him that he shouldn't be housing with us. We are making provisions to keep him on the lower part of the house, and we're going to exchange food with him via the stairway, but we're going to try and keep our interaction limited. Is that okay?
So according to CDC guidelines, that's exactly what you want to do. So you want to limit your contact. Again, it doesn't mean you have to kind of lock him in the basement and come back in 14 days and say hi.
I might want to,
I'm sure you're happy to have him back from the Peace Corps.
Yeah, I know.
So really it's now presumably he's not showing any symptoms. It's really just a precaution because again, there's some chance that asymptomatic individuals could pass the virus. And again, if the lack of testing, it's hard to say whether someone at this point is positive or negative for the virus. So a little level of precaution is necessary. So again, handing the food kind of off to him, limiting contact, making sure he washes his hands, disinfects surfaces in his room, that you disinfect surfaces in other parts of the house. And just monitor yourself for symptoms. I think right now the main way the virus is being spread, I should say, is through individuals with clear symptoms that are coughing, that are spreading respiratory droplets. It's not to say that the virus can't be spread by other means, but that seems to be the main way the virus is being spread.
Would you recommend gloves for the parents?
I think gloves, if you can find them, aren't a bad idea. Gloves that fit. The gloves, I think when you start wearing different PPE, there's always some level of information and training that's required. And gloves, again, you want to kind of use one use only. Make sure gloves don't have rips or tears in them. So definitely if you want to be a little bit more heightened level of precaution, you can pass off the food to him wearing gloves.
Okay.
And then remove the gloves and throw them away.
All right.
I would recommend there's probably videos you can find online. There's a defined way to remove a glove so it doesn't touch other parts of your body. Again, it doesn't sound like at this point your son is carrying the disease.
All right.
But the gloves are, you could definitely try them out.
Eric, I'm afraid we're done for this time around, but you know we're going to be calling you again, and I really appreciate it, man. Have a good weekend.
I'm happy to. You too, Ray. I appreciate it.
Be safe out there. And support comes from Theta Dermatology, celebrating 25 years serving the Capital Region and surrounding areas, a medical practice specializing in dermatology and dermatologic surgery. When it comes to skin, this practice is in thetadermatology.com. Pekarsky's, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, family-owned since 1948, offering sausages from kielbasa to Italian to bratwurst and smoked meats, home of New England farm-made sausage, open 7 days, Pekarsky's.com. At Rolling Rock Farm Salt and Seasonings, Sheffield, Massachusetts, handcrafted in small batches, infused sea salts, peppers, and blends, specializing in garlic and hot pepper blends, RollingRockSalt.com. For upcoming events. Thanks again to Dr. Eric Yeager for being with us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Dina Salzman answered the phones. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Have a safe weekend. We'll see you Monday.